Chapter 3. London and Harrogate Again. It was late evening along Fleet Street, and the London night was clear and unseasonably warm, as if the enormous moon that swam in the purple sky above the dome of St. Paul's were radiating a thin white heat. The very luminosity of the moon paled the surrounding stars, but as the night deepened where it fell away into space, the stars winked on and brightened and thickened in such a way as to remind St. Ives that the universe wasn't an empty place after all. And out there, among the planets, hurtling towards Earth, was a vast comet, its curved tail 100 million miles of showering ice blown by solar wind along the uncharted byways of space. St. Ives could see it. Tomorrow or the next day, the man in the street, peering skyward to admire the stars, would see it too. Would it be a thing of startling beauty, a wash of fire across the canvas of heaven? Or would it send a thrill of fear through a populace still veined with the superstitious dread of the medieval church? The shuffle of footsteps behind him brought St. Ives to himself. He wrinkled his face up, feeling the gluey pull of the horsehair eyebrows and beard, which, along with a putty nose and monk's wig, made up a fairly suitable disguise. Coming along towards him was Beezer the journalist, talking animatedly with a man in shirt sleeves. Beezer chewed the end of a tiny cigar and waved his arms to illustrate a story that he told with particular venom. He seemed unnaturally excited, although St. Ives had to remind himself that he was almost entirely unfamiliar with the man. Perhaps he always gestured and railed so. St. Ives fell in behind the two, making no effort to conceal himself. Hasbro and Jack Owlsby stood in the shadows 2 blocks further along in the alley past Whitefriars. There was precious little time to waste. Occasional strollers passed. The abduction would have to be quick and subtle. "Excuse me, Mr. Beezer, is it? The journalist?" The two men stopped, looking back at St. Ives. Beezer's hands fell to his side. "That's right, Pappy," came the reply. Beezer squinted at him, as if ready to doubt the existence of such a wild figure on the evening street. "My name is actually Penrod," said St. Ives. "Jules Penrod. You've apparently mistaken me for someone else. I have one of the 12 common faces." Beezer's companion burst into abrupt laughter at the idea. Beezer, however, seemed impatient at the interruption. "Face like yours is a pity," he said, nudging his companion in the abdomen with his elbow. "Suits a beggar, though. Haven't got a thing for you, Pappy. Go scrub yourself with a sponge." And with that, the two of them turned and made away, the second man laughing again and Beezer gesturing. "One moment, sir," cried St. Ives, pursuing the pair. "We've a mutual friend." Beezer turned and scowled, chewing his cigar slowly and thoughtfully. He stared carefully at St. Ives' unlikely visage and shook his head. "No, we don't," he said, "unless it's the devil. Any other friend of yours would have hung himself by now, out of regret. Why don't you disappear into the night, Pappy, before I show you the shine on my boot?" "You're right, as far as it goes," said St. Ives, grinning inwardly. "I'm a friend of Dr. Ignacio Narbondo, in fact. He sent me round with another communication." Beezer squinted at him. The word "another" hadn't jarred him. "Is that right?" he said. St. Ives bowed, clapping a hand hastily to the top of his head to hold his wig on. "Bugger off, will you, Clyde?" Beezer said to his friend. "My drink," came the reply. "Stow your drink. I'll see you tomorrow, and I'll buy you two. Now get along." The man turned away regretfully, despondent over his lost drink, perhaps, and St. Ives waited until he'd crossed Whitefriars and his footsteps faded out of earshot before he spoke. He nodded to the still scowling Beezer and set out in the wake of the departed Clyde, looking up and down the street as if to discern anything suspicious or threatening. Beezer fell in beside him. "It's about the money," said St. Ives. "The money?" "Narbondo fears he promised you too much of it." "He's a filthy cheat," cried Beezer, eliminating any doubts that St. Ives might have had about Beezer's having received Narbondo's message. "He's discovered," continued St. Ives, "and there are any number of journalists who will sell out the people of London for half the sum. Peabody the Herald, for example, has agreed to cooperate." "The filthy scum-sucking cheat," Beezer shouted, waving both hands over his head. "Tut, tut," admonished St. Ives, noting with a surge of anxious anticipation the darkened mouth of the alley some 30 feet distant. "We haven't contracted with Peabody yet. It's merely a matter of feeling out the temperature of the water, so to speak. You understand. You're a businessman yourself in that way." St. Ives gestured broadly with his left hand as if to signify that a man like Beezer could be expected to take the long view. With his right hand, he reached across and snatched the lapels of Beezer's coat, then brought his left hand around and pummeled the startled journalist square in the back, catapulting him into the ill-lit alley. Hey! Shouted Beezer, tripping forward into the waiting arms of Jack Owlsby, who leaped in to pinion the man's wrists. Hasbro waved an enormous bag, appearing from the shadows, and flung the bag like a gill net over Beezer's head, St. Ives yanking it down across the man's back and pushing him forward off his feet. Hasbro snatched at the draw rope, grasped Beezer's shoulders, and hissed through the canvas, "Cry out and you're a dead man." The struggling Beezer collapsed like a sprung balloon, having an antipathy, apparently, to the idea of being a dead man. Jack clambered up onto the bed of a standing wagon, hauled open the lid of a steamer trunk, and along with St. Ives and Hasbro, yanked and shoved and grappled the feebly struggling journalist into the wooden leather prison. He banged ineffectively a half dozen times at the sides of the trunk, mewling miserably, and then fell silent as the wagon rattled and bounced along the alley, exiting on Salisbury Court and making its way south towards the Thames. An hour later, the wagon had swerved around the embankment and doubled back through Soho as St. Ives set a course toward Chingford. Hasbro, always prepared, had uncorked a bottle of whiskey, and each of the three men held a glass, lost in his own thoughts about the warm April night and the dangers of their mission. "Sorry to bring you in on this, Jack," said St. Ives. "There might quite likely be the devil to pay before we're through. No telling what sort of row our man Beezer might set up." "I'm not complaining," said Jack Owlsby, grinning gamely at St. Ives. "It was Dorothy I was thinking about, actually. We're only weeks finished with the pig incident, and I've hauled you away again. There she sits in Kensington, wondering what sort of nonsense I've drummed up now. She's a stout woman, if you don't mistake my meaning." Jack nodded. If Dorothy knew, in fact, what sort of business they pursued this time, she'd have insisted on coming along. Jack thought of her fondly. "Do you know," he began, reminiscing, but the sound of Beezer pummeling the sides of the trunk cut him off. "Tell the hunchback," shrieked a muffled voice, "that I'll have him horsewhipped. He'll be sulking in Newgate Prison by the end of the week. By God, there's nothing about him I don't know." St. Ives shrugged at Hasbro. Here, perhaps, was a stroke of luck. If Beezer could be convinced that they actually were agents of Narbondo, it would go no little way towards throwing the man off their scent when the affair was over, especially if he went to the authorities with his tale. He hadn't, after all, committed any crime, nor did he contemplate one. No crime, that is, beyond the crime against humanity, against human decency. "Narbondo has authorized us to eliminate you if we see fit," said St. Ives, hunching over the trunk. "If you play along here, you'll be well paid. If you struggle, you'll find yourself counting fishes in the rocks off Southend Pier." The journalist fell silent. Early in the pre-dawn morning, the wagon rattled into Chingford and made for the hills beyond, where lay the cottage of Sam Langley, son of St. Ives' longtime cook. The cottage was dark, but a lamp burned through the slats and the locked shutters of a low window in an unused silo 50 yards off. St. Ives reined in the horse, clambered out of the wagon at once, and with the help of his two companions, hauled the steamer trunk off the tailgate and into the unfastened door of the silo. Jack Owlsby and Hasbro hastened back out into the night, and for a moment, through the hastily opened door, St. Ives could see Sam Langley stepping off his kitchen porch and pulling on a coat. The door shut, and St. Ives was alone in the feebly lit silo with the trunk and a scattered pieces of furniture. "I'm going to unlock the trunk," St. Ives began. "You sons of—" Beezer started to shout, but St. Ives rapped against the lid of the trunk with his knuckles to silence him. "I'm either going to unlock the trunk or set it on fire," said St. Ives with great deliberation. "The choice is yours." The trunk was silent. "Once the trunk is unlocked, you can quite easily extricate yourself. The bag isn't knotted. You've probably already discovered that. My advice to you is to stay absolutely still for 10 minutes. Then you can thrash and shriek and stamp about until you collapse. No one will hear you. You'll be happy to hear that a quantity of money will be advanced to your account, and that you'll have a far easier time spending it if you're not chock full of holes. Don't, then, get impatient. You've ridden out the night in the trunk. You can stand 10 minutes more." Beezer, it seemed, had seen reason, for as St. Ives crouched out into the night, shook hands hastily with Langley, leaped into the wagon, and took up the ribbons, nothing but silence emanated from the stones of the silo. Two evenings earlier, on the night that St. Ives had waylaid Beezer the journalist, the comet had appeared in the eastern sky, ghostly and round like the moon reflected on a frosty window, just a circular patch of faint, luminous cloud. But now it seemed to drop out of the heavens toward the earth like a plum bob toward a melon. St. Ives peered into the eyepiece of his meager telescope, tracking the flight of the comet for no other reason, really, than to while away the early dawn hours. There was nothing to calculate. Work of that nature had been accomplished weeks past by astronomers whose knowledge of astral mathematics was sufficient to satisfy both the Royal Academy and Dr. Ignacio Norbando. St. Ives wouldn't dispute it. His desire, beyond a simple fascination with the mystery and wonder of the thing, was to have a look at the face of what might easily be his last great nemesis. The glow of the lights of Leeds, and to a much lesser extent the lights of Kirkhamerton, obscured the clarity of the heavens, and the billows of the clouds along the northern horizon threatened at any moment to roil up across the sky and cover the sky utterly. His telescope, with its mirror of speculum metal, had been a gift of Lord Rosse, and through it St. Ives had seen years past the strange lunar activity that had led very nearly to his death, and to the final cataclysmic parting of ways with the Royal Academy of Sciences. The telescope, however, was wasted here. He could have seen the comet clearly through his window. His brass spyglass alone was sufficient to turn the thing into a monster hurtling among the planets. But his fascination with the simple presence of the deadly star drew him to his observatory as a curious child is drawn to the edge of a deep and terrifying precipice. Hasbro packed their bags in the manor. The train left Kirkhamerton station at 6. Dr. Norbando, St. Ives had to assume, would discover that same morning that he'd been foiled, that Beezer somehow had failed. The morning Times would rattle in on the Dover train, ignorant of the pending doom. The doctor would try to contact the nefarious Beezer, but Beezer wouldn't be found. "He's taken ill," they'd say, repeating the substance of the letter St. Ives had sent off to Beezer's employees. Beezer, they'd assure Norbando, had been ordered south on holiday to the north coast of Spain. Norbando's forehead would wrinkle with suspicion, and the wrinkling would engender horrible curses and the gnashing of teeth. St. Ives smiled. The doctor wouldn't have an inkling of who had thwarted him. But the result of the mystery of the disappeared journalist would, quite likely, be the immediate removal of Norbando and Hargreaves to the environs of southwestern Scandinavia. The chase, thought St. Ives romantically, would be on. The comet loomed only a few days away, barely enough time to accomplish their task. A door slammed in the manor. St. Ives slipped down from his stool and looked out through the west-facing window of his observatory, waving to Hasbro, who, in the roseate light of early dawn, dangled a pocket watch from a chain and nodded to his employer. In half an hour they were away, scouring along the high road toward the station in Kirkhamerton, St. Ives, Hasbro, and Jack Owlsbury bound for Ramsgate to board the Zeppelin that would transport them to the ice and tundra of Arctic Norway. If the labors of Bill Kraken were unsuccessful, they'd know 2 days hence. Bill Kraken crouched in the willows along the River Nid, watching through the lacy tendrils the dark bulk of Lord Kelvin's barn. The device had been finished 2 days earlier, the ironic result, to a degree, of his own labor. Labor he would never be paid for. But money wasn't of particular consequence anymore. Not like it had been in the days of his squid merchanting, or when he'd been rescued from the life of a lowly peapod man by the charitable Langdon St. Ives. He wanted for nothing now, really, beyond the success of the night's mission. In a cloth bag beside him wriggled the dozen snakes collected by Kraken in the high grass beyond the manor house. In a wire screen cage beneath the snakes were a score of mice, hungry as were the snakes, from days of neglect. A leather bellows dangled from his belt and a hooded lantern from his right hand. No one, apparently, was on the meadow. The Royal Academy was glad to be quit of Ignacio Norbando, who had taken the ship for Oslo, word had it, to effect his machinations. But the Royal Academy would be in before him. They would reduce his threats to drivel. Why he hadn't followed through with his plan to alert the press, they couldn't say, but it seemed to be evidence that his threats were merely a bluff. This latest turn had lightened the atmosphere considerably, it seemed to Kraken. It had lent a sort of holiday air to what had been a business fraught with suspicion and doubt. He bent out from under the willows and set off across the meadow carrying his bundles. It would do no good to run. He was too old to be cutting capers on the meadow in the dead of night, and if he tripped and dropped the mice or knocked his lantern against a stone, his plan would be foiled utterly. In an hour, both the moon and the comet would have appeared on the horizon, and the meadow would be bathed in light. If he was sensible, he'd be asleep in bed before then. The dark bulk of the barn loomed towards him, the pale stones of its foundation contrasting feebly with the weathered oak battens above. Kraken ducked along the wall toward a tiny mullioned window beneath which extended the last 6 inches of the final section of brass pipe, the very pipe which Kraken himself had wrestled through a hole augured into the barn wall on that first day he'd helped Lord Kelvin align the things. What exactly the pipe was intended to accomplish, Kraken couldn't say, but somehow it was the focal point of the workings of the device. Beyond, some 20 feet from the barn and elevated on a stone slab, sat a black monolith, smooth as polished marble. Kraken had been amazed when, late the previous evening, Lord Kelvin had flung a ball-peen hammer end over end at the monolith, and the collected workmen and scientists had gasped in wonder when the hammer had been soundlessly reflected with such force that it had sailed out of sight in the general direction of York. That it had come to Earth yet, not a man of them could say. The reversal of the poles was to be accomplished, then, by emanating the collected magnetic rays developed in Lord Kelvin's machine towards the monolith, thus both exciting and deflecting them in a circuitous pattern, sending them off, as it were, astride a penny whirligig. Kraken squinted through the darkness at the monolith, doubly black against the purple of the starry night sky, and wondered at the wonderful perspicacity of great scientists. Given 1,000 years, 2,000, Kraken couldn't have thought up such a machine, let alone engineer the building of one. But here it was, primed for acceleration on the morrow. Could Kraken, a man of admittedly low intellect, scuttle the marvelous device? Kraken shook his head, suddenly full of doubt. He'd been entrusted with little else than the material salvation of humanity. Well, Kraken was just a small man with a small way of doing things. He'd seen low times in his life, had mucked through sewers with murderers, and he'd have to trust to low means here. That was the best he could do. He quit breathing and cocked an ear. Nothing but silence and the distant hooting of an owl greeted him on the night air. He untied the bellows from his belt and shook them against his ear. Grain and broken biscuits rattled within. He shoved the mouth of the bellows into the end of the brass tube and pumped furiously, listening to the debris clatter away down the tilted pipe. Long after the last grain had been blown clear by the bellows, Kraken continued to manipulate his instrument, desperate to send the bulk of it deep into the bowels of the machine. Haste would avail him nothing here. Satisfied, he tied the bellows once again to his belt and picked up the mouse cage. The beasts were tumultuous with excitement, stimulated, perhaps, by the evening constitutional, or sensing somehow that they were on the brink of an adventure of powerful magnitude. Kraken pressed the cage front against the end of the tube and pulled open its little door. The mice scurried roundabout, casting wild glances here and there, suddenly curious about a heap of shredded newspaper or the pink ear of a neighbor. Then, one by one, they filed away down the tube like cattle down a hill, sniffing the air, intent, suddenly, on biscuits and grain. The snakes were a comparatively easy case. A round dozen of the beasts fled away in the wake of the mice, anxious to be quit of their sack. Kraken wondered if he ought to wad up the sack and shove it into the tube to make absolutely sure the beast remained within. But the dangers of doing so were manifold. Lord Kelvin or some particularly wrathful guard might easily discover the stopper before Kraken had a chance to remove it. They mustn't, said St. Ives, discover that the sabotage had been the work of men, thus the mice and snakes. It might easily seem that the natural residents of the barn merely taken up lodging there, and the hand of Langdon Cyanives would go undetected. It was very nearly within the hour that Bill Kraken climbed into bed, but his dreams were filled that night with visions of mice and snakes dribbling from the end of the tube and racing away into the darkness, having consumed the grain and leaving nothing behind sufficient to foul the workings of the dread machine. What could he do, though, save trust to Providence? The shame of his failure, if failure it should be, would likely be as nothing next to the horrors that would beset them after Lord Kelvin's success. God bless the man, thought Kraken philosophically, picturing the aging lord laboring night and day to complete his engine, certain he was contributing his greatest gift yet to mankind. His disappointment would be monumental. It seemed almost worth the promised trouble to let the poor man have a go at it. But that, sadly, wouldn't do. The world was certainly a contradictory place.